6. Mayor of Crazy Town. A lot of people sling ideas around to fix Washington, and most of them are crap. But there's at least one thing that every single American citizen, no matter where they live, can do to help set things right in the nation's capital. You can vote to send people there to represent you who actually want to get things done, instead of hucksters making pie-in-the-sky promises or legislative terrorists just looking to go to Washington and blow everything up. Pick an issue you care about. It doesn't really matter what it is, whether it's the economy or healthcare or immigration or national security. No meaningful progress will ever be made unless we elect serious people who truly want to make progress. Some may say that's surrender, and if that we just elect enough people to office who think like us, eventually we'll be able to do everything our way. Well, if you think like that, chances are you're part of the problem. As polarized as this country is, there are plenty of hardliners on both sides, from the Jim Jordans on the right to the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortezes on the left. And the reason the House of Representatives has been swinging back and forth between Democrat and Republican control in recent years is because the key to getting a majority lies in a few dozen swing districts. So no, we're not going to see some massive Democrat or Republican majority storm into Congress ready to usher in a conservative or liberal utopia anytime soon. That means whoever is in charge is still going to have to find common ground with the other side to get things done. I always try to remember that common ground and compromise were very different things. You can find common ground with others without having to compromise your own beliefs. That's how you actually get things done. I get it. It's fun to vote out of anger. Let's send this clown to the Capitol with a pack of matches and some gasoline. But it's also very dangerous. There are people we are electing who will destroy this country if we aren't careful. Doesn't matter whether they call themselves conservatives or progressives. Many of them are actually neither. Trust me, I know. I worked with a lot of these people, and I fought with them plenty. Sometimes they were just annoying, but sometimes they were downright destructive. Lots of people think they only started showing up in Congress in 2010, products of the Tea Party, the so-called grassroots conservative movement, more like a payday for Washington fundraisers, but more on that later. Anyway, these folks were around for years. They'd already come damn near close to destroying the American economy. They thought it would be fun to play kamikaze pilot on a plane in which our economic growth, including your job and wages, as well as those of your family, was strapped in the back seat. It's one hell of a scary story. You may recall in 2008, when George W. Bush was in his final year as president, America experienced the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression. There were a lot of reasons for this, which I could get into, but plenty of others have already done that. The point is that many major American companies, along with our entire banking system, were on the verge of collapse. As the House Republican leader, I was one of the first in Congress who was clued in early on what was happening. I got updates directly from Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson and Ben Bernanke, the chairman of the Federal Reserve. I'll never forget one scene as long as I live. Paulson was telling us we were facing a worldwide depression. Meanwhile, as he was talking, I kept glancing over at Bernanke. His lips were trembling. That's when I knew this was a major deal. You don't often get to see well-heeled Wall Street types shaking in their boots. What the administration wanted from Congress was a massive bailout bill. The price tag was monumental, $700 billion to bail out some of these banks. And that was just for starters. The Treasury Secretary was in effect asking for a fat blank check to do pretty much whatever he wanted with the money. I knew my people in the House. This wasn't going to smell right to them, and to be honest, I wasn't very excited about it either. I was one of the biggest evangelists for fiscal discipline there was. I've been fighting for a smaller, less costly, and more accountable federal government for years alongside many of them. Republicans generally didn't do bailouts of failing industries, and certainly not with that kind of price tag. But President Bush was determined. He didn't want to be this generation's Herbert Hoover, and who could blame him? Paulson and Bernanke were scaring the hell out of us and talking about people going to ATMs and not being able to get money and major companies shutting their doors. Nancy Pelosi, who was then Speaker, seemed like she could get her people in line as usual. So did Senators Harry Reid, Mitch McConnell. Those two guys always seemed to have the numbers they needed. Now it was up to me. That was just great. These guys had no clue what kind of clown car I was trying to drive on the Republican side of the House. This plan was going to be DOA on our side of the Capitol, and I knew it. But I still had to give it a try. So I made the case to the Republican members, and of course, got it all thrown back in my face. Some of them said bluntly that if companies and banks were failing because of their own dumb mistakes, we should let them. Others didn't like just giving Paulson, a Wall Street guy before he came to Treasury, a ton of money for him to kick back to his old Wall Street pals. Frankly, I could see the logic in these arguments, and I said so. I shared their hang-ups. In a normal situation, I probably would have been on the same side. But we were not facing any normal situation. This was a full-blown crisis, and was only going to get worse if we didn't act. I kept trying to conjure up all the images from the last Great Depression. A run on the banks, people not being able to buy food, all these companies going out of business. Trying to make clear that instead of this happening to people in old black and white newsreels, this would be happening to their constituents back home. It's unusual for such a divide to exist between the member of one party sitting in the White House and the members of the same party in Congress. But by this point in his administration, my friend George Bush had pretty much lost all credibility with conservatives, who hated his view on immigration, and the rest of the country, who were tired of the war in Iraq. I remembered fighting hard with him to get education reform past many of these same cranks back when he first came to office. So much had happened since then. And now he was in a tough spot. I really felt for the guy. Every time he went out to speak about the urgent need to address the financial crisis, the stock market plummeted by hundreds of points. They even sent Dick Cheney over to the House to try to talk to people into supporting the relief plan. A former Republican conference chair, who made it all the way to the vice presidency, Cheney had conservative credibility that nobody could question. But the members still weren't buying it. Then almost out of nowhere, Senator John McCain decided to pop in. This was the last thing anyone needed, including, as it turned out, John himself. McCain was, at this point, our party's nominee for president. He was in a tough race against his fellow senator, Barack Obama, and had been spending most of his time away from Washington and out on the campaign trail looking for votes. This was where he should have stayed. I loved John McCain. He was a war hero, a tough son of a bitch, funny as hell. But he was never a favorite among the far-right crazies. They remembered his support of immigration reform and cooperation with Democrats on a few too many issues for their liking. He'd been too much of a maverick, to use his own word. Plenty of people in the party had less charitable words to describe him. But John didn't care. When you've been where he'd been and seen what he'd seen, petty insults and political bullshit couldn't faze you. Still, the man wanted to be president of the United States, and he was a skilled politician. He knew that in order to win, he had to energize the conservative base. And so he picked one of the chief crazies as his running mate, an Alaska governor no one had ever heard of, named Sarah Palin. I had met her sometime earlier with some other members. Nobody had come away exactly impressed by her deep knowledge of government. A few of the other members had commented on her looks. But she did energize the base, which may or may not have been a good thing. I never figured John as an expert on economics. National security was more his ballpark. But this didn't stop him from announcing he was suspending his presidential campaign, whatever that meant, to come to Washington at once to help deal with the financial crisis. It was a dramatic move and got a lot of attention. I guess it was meant to show that he was a leader who had put the country ahead of his own interest. At least I figure he was going to come to D.C. with some kind of plan. Republicans and a House mayor may not have liked him all that much, but he was going to be on top of the ticket that fall. Most of them would probably get in line with whatever he was going to propose, if only because it might impact their own elections. And believe me, if anyone else wanted to take charge of the asylum for a while and give me a break, they were welcome to the keys. So I was a little surprised when John, freshly arrived from the campaign trail, walked into the middle of my daily management meeting on the day we were due to go to a meeting with congressional Democrats at the White House. He walked in, plopped down on the couch, and looked at me. He was alone, as far as I could see. He wasn't holding a folder that said Miracle Solution on it. As a matter of fact, he wasn't carrying anything. Maybe he had it all in his head. "So what's the plan for today, John?" I asked him. "Well, that's why I'm here," McCain replied. "What's the plan?" "What's the plan? Is that what he just asked me?" At first, I thought he must have meant the logistics. When we were supposed to be at the White House, who else was going, and so on. He couldn't have meant what it looked like he meant. So I clarified, "What do you plan on saying at the White House today?" "I don't know," he said. I tried to keep my mouth from flopping open. "What do you think I should say?" Now, I was a little troubled. If I'd had a cigarette in my mouth, I might have swallowed it. "Where are your staff?" "I don't have any staff with me." Oh, Lord. Now it was clear. There wasn't anybody who was going to get us out of this mess. No cavalry was coming. And though I didn't think it was possible that the mess had somehow gotten worse. When I woke up that day, all I had to do was turn around a stubborn Republican conference, cut a deal with Democrats they hated, help save our economy, and stop a global depression. Now I had to find some way to help the nominee of our party look like he knew what he was doing, and it was still morning. I turned to Mike Summers, my top policy staffer. "You're staffing McCain today," I said, and Summers nodded. Later, we all headed over to the White House to meet with President Bush and House and Senate leaders from both parties. The Democrats brought their own last-minute addition to the party, the junior senator from Illinois, Barack Obama. The Democrat presidential nominee decided if McCain was going to get on this action, he ought to be there too. The whole thing was a disaster from start to finish. The Republicans showed up early to meet with President Bush and strategized for the bigger bipartisan showdown. I'm using the term strategize loosely. As I've said, George W. Bush was and still a great friend of mine. I like him and respect him. But sometimes even a friend, even a president, can tick you off. One thing you have to understand about Bush is that he likes to dig at you when he senses you're vulnerable about something. And he knew I was having a hell of a time corralling Republican votes. So he started to complain to me I couldn't get it done and went after me in front of all these other guys in a room. I had seen this needling before from him. Guys do it all the time. It's usually not a big deal. But at that moment, we had the national and probably the world economy hanging in the balance, and he still wanted to trot out this frat house trash-talking bullshit. Nobody had time for that. So I admit I snapped. Looking at Paulson, who kept telling House Republicans to give him a blank check, I said something like, "Mr. President, if Paulson had any fucking ears, we wouldn't be in this position." Well, that pissed Paulson off, understandably. Let's just say tempers were frayed. So Bush wisely decided our pregame meeting had come to an end. Now it was time to meet with the Democrats. And they were coaching their MVP from the beginning. Senator Obama was front and center. I saw him huddling before our meeting in the cabinet room with Pelosi and Reid, scheming about how this was all going to go down. I felt for John McCain. He wanted to do something to help. He wanted to show leadership. He truly was the kind of guy who tried to put the country before party. But, as I said, he would have been better off out on the campaign trail. As we took our seats, I sat next to McCain and told him to keep quiet. As far as I was concerned, the less he said about this mess, the better. He wasn't going to fix it anyway. No single politician could. But apparently nobody told Obama to keep quiet. He led off of the Democrat side and sounded, at least, like he knew what he was talking about. Bush decided he had no choice but to call on McCain to go next, and did so. But a nominee just shook his head and said, "I'll wait my turn." Well, I don't know why he did that. Maybe he thought Obama looked arrogant speaking for the Democrats and wanted to set a better example himself by deferring to the more senior lawmakers in the room. That may have been noble, but it didn't exactly show a take-charge attitude from the guy who had suspended his campaign to come back to Washington to figure this out. So I started talking, in part to help John, and started going over what we would need in order to deliver enough votes from House Republicans for the relief package. Other people started to chime in about the House situation, and it looked like we might be getting somewhere, when all of a sudden Obama pipes up again, probably sensing McCain's discomfort, and he said, "Oh, I'd like to hear what McCain has to say." Uh-oh. In just a moment, this had gone from a discussion on how to save the world economy to a political pissing match. Obama knew exactly what he was doing. McCain stepped up to the plate and tossed out a word salad, positive-sounding generalizations that might have sounded good to people who weren't really following along, but didn't have much actual substance. Unfortunately, everyone in the room was following along closely. I saw Obama sort of smile. I think he knew at that moment he'd won the election. I think John knew he'd lost it. Even President Bush, whose relationship with McCain after their nasty 2000 primary battle had thawed, but wasn't exactly warm, seemed confused by the current nominee's contribution to the meeting. "What the hell was that all about?" he asked me afterwards. I've heard since that it was bad staff work on McCain's campaign team that pushed him to suspend his campaign and left him unprepared to discuss the nuts and bolts of the looming crisis. It was his top political hands who wanted him to make the grand gesture of suspending his campaign to hopefully grab some headlines. At the same time, these same political aides had frozen the campaign's top economic advisor out of key meetings, leaving the candidate without the critical information he needed to make a plan after announcing the suspension. In any event, McCain took a risk in suspending his campaign. And while the action may have helped him capture a news cycle, he didn't have a plan to follow through. We saw that in the White House meeting, and unfortunately, the American people saw it too. Never make a move without knowing your next one. John and I were friends until he died, but I don't think he was ever quite the same after his loss in 2008. Things only got worse for me as I tried to rally Republicans in my conference to salvage our economy. McCain's efforts hadn't helped anything. His endorsement of the bailout bill, which became known as the Troubled Asset Relief Program, or TARP, moved few votes. The vast majority of Republicans voted against the bill when it came up for a vote. One congressman, Michigan's Fred Upton, started updating us on the collapse of the Dow Jones Industrial Average as the vote looked doomed to failure. It was dropping by 100 points, then 300, then 500. I said a prayer. I truly feared our economy was going to move to a very dark place, and there was little I could do but let it happen. Too many Republicans in Congress cared more about what Sean Hannity thought than the Secretary of the Treasury, or the Speaker of the House, or the President of the United States. They were ready to destroy the economy for decades rather than come up with any realistic alternatives, just as long as it looked as though they were standing up to the establishment. We were, to put it bluntly, screwed. Some of the more reasonable members were panicked, but the nuts were even more emboldened. They were proud to send this bill to its death, and they didn't give a shit if the economy collapsed. Various outside groups, such as the so-called Senate Conservatives Fund, headed by Jim DeMint, egged them on. This was all being done in the name of conservative purity, they claimed, so that we could finally elect real, honest-to-goodness defenders of fiscal discipline and a balanced budget. That was supposedly what the Tea Party movement was all about. But I knew the truth. It was a story I would see played out over and over again in the next few years. It wasn't about any so-called principles. It was about chaos. But it was chaos that developed into a predictable pattern. The far-right knuckleheads would refuse to back the House leadership no matter what. But because they were insurgents, they never had the responsibility of trying to actually fix things themselves. So they got to burn it all down and screw up the legislative process, which of course allowed them to continue to complain loudly about how Washington's spending problem never got solved. That kept their favorite straw man alive to take more hits. And every time they punched him, they got another invitation to go on Fox News or on talk radio, or they got another check from their friends and outside groups like DeMint's outfit. It was their own little private stimulus plan. Now they were willing to let every business in America collapse, every bank fail, ATM stop working, just so they could pretend to be budget cutters. It was pathetic, irresponsible, but it was only the beginning. We ultimately did scrape together a sufficient number of sane Republicans to side with a sufficient number of sane Democrats and pass a bill. Things leveled off. The crisis passed. But none of the so-called conservatives who are willing to blow up our economy ever paid any price. And they never acknowledged that the plan they vilified actually worked. In fact, TARP turned out to be one of the most successful economic measures ever passed by Congress. All of the money spent was paid back, with interest, by the companies we saved from collapse. Not to mention, it stopped another Great Depression across the world. But none of that mattered to people who had already decided that everyone in Washington was corrupt, that the leaders were liars, and that the system was rigged against them. All this happened under a Republican president, George W. Bush, who had once been praised as the most conservative president since Reagan. Now he's generally considered a liberal sellout failure by many of these same people who glommed onto Trump, who, as I've mentioned, ballooned the national debt. Things got even worse, as noted, when Barack Obama, whom was immediately identified by this crowd as a mysterious closet Muslim who wasn't born in America. I was living in Crazy Town now, and when I took the Speaker's gavel in 2011, 2 years into the Obama presidency, I became its mayor. Crazy Town was populated by jackasses and media hounds and some normal citizens as baffled as I was about how we got trapped inside the city walls. Every second of every day since Barack Obama became president, I was finding one batshit idea after another. The first one, as I mentioned, was that Obama wasn't a citizen. Then I couldn't even play golf for the guy without looking like public enemy number one. I tried not to let craziness and personal attacks against the president get in the way. I knew we had serious work to do. We campaigned to take back the House in 2010 by asking the American people a simple question. Where are the jobs? Between Obamacare and weak economic growth, there weren't many jobs, and Americans deserve better. I wanted to do my damnedest to help create the conditions that would let businesses create more jobs and put more Americans back to work. That's what I vowed to do from the moment I took the Speaker's gavel. I'll never forget the moment Nancy Pelosi passed me that huge, oversized gavel that we were using for the ceremony. That gavel had been made for me by a woodworker buddy back in Ohio, Dick Slagle, after I'd won the conference election to be Speaker. The recess before I was sworn in, I got together with some friends, Pete DeBrosi, Tom Hazelbaker, and Dick, for breakfast at the Bob Evans in Westchester, and they presented me with this gavel. It looked oversized, but by the time I was taking it from Nancy Pelosi at the podium, it seemed to have grown 10 times bigger. But Dick made a fine piece of woodwork. So I was standing up there with this gigantic gavel, and I was supposed to make a speech. But there, sitting in the front row, I caught sight of my three best buddies, Richard Burr, Zaxby Jambliss, and Tom Latham, all sitting together. We've been friends since our early days in Congress, and there they were, Burr and Jambliss having come over from the Senate to wish me well. That was it. The waterworks opened. I had to go through a lot of tissues that day. But then it was down to business. It was our job in the leadership to keep the conference focused on what we could actually do with our power. At the time, Republicans controlled one half of one third of the government to help as many Americans as possible. A big part of how we did that was helping our members do their jobs well, especially the new folks. There were a lot of new members taking office in 2011. One thing we consistently advised on was how to set up a good staff. Congressional staff usually gets overlooked or sometimes even picked on, but they're the ones who keep America's representative government going. The average population of a congressional district in America in 2010 was 710,767 people, which is a lot for one person to handle on their own, or even a dozen people, which is about how big most congressional staffs are, give or take. The top person in an office, right under the member, is the chief of staff, who makes sure everyone is doing their job and is usually the member's top advisor. The scheduler is the one who keeps everyone, boss, staff, running on time. On the legislative side, you have a legislative director and a few legislative assistants who keep an eye on the House floor and handle certain policy issues for the boss. Then there's the communication director who writes everything from press releases to tweets. Legislative correspondence, answer mail from folks back home. And then the staff assistant and interns answer the phones and do what they can for everyone else to try to gain some experience. Most folks move up the same way. In my experience, a member is only as good as the staff they have around them. That was something we tried to impart on every new member as they tried to get their offices set up. Make sure you hire the best. Of course, plenty of members have to do things their own way, especially, as we noted early on, in the class of 2010. Every once in a while, one of the kooks would even argue that we should impeach the president, which I never took seriously for a single second. And to their credit, neither did the vast majority of the Republican members. But every time we went up against the administration, I knew there was someone else in the Republican conference who was looking at me and thinking they could do a better job of running the show. They thought they'd be smarter, tougher, more determined. And if only it was them in charge instead of that softy Boehner there, we'd be able to roll over the Democrats like a bulldozer. So there were coup plots against me, but only occasionally, more and more constant with the leaks to the media. I tried not to let things like this bother me too much, but it's still a kick to the gut when someone on your team actively throws a wrench in the gears. Representative Eric Cantor of Virginia was the House Majority Leader when I was Speaker, and it was our job to work closely together with the rest of the leadership team to follow through on the promises of limited government that the American people voted for when they helped Republicans take over the House in 2010. Eric and I were as different as you can imagine. For one thing, I was a blunt, Rust Belt Yankee, and he was a smooth Southern gentleman. But the two of us got along fine. Some of our staffers never meshed, and the friction between them often came after somebody gave away details of an internal House leadership discussion that had been kept private so that people weren't afraid to speak their minds. These leaks almost always ended up making it harder for everybody involved. But the leaks ended up not being the worst thing Eric had to deal with. He and I had been through some bruising fights together, and I had worked hard to help him get ready to take over as the next speaker, when, out of nowhere, to everyone's surprise, especially his own, he lost the 2014 Republican primary to a Tea Party radical. The House Majority Leader position was created in 1899. And in the 115 years since, no sitting holder of that office had ever been booted in a primary. Cantor's Tea Party replacement, by the way, didn't last long. Just after two terms, he lost in 2018 to a moderate Democrat, flipping the seat from red to blue. Cantor's loss was a waste. A good member and a good leader taken out of the House just when he was most needed. Knocking Cantor off, of course, only emboldened the radicals to come after me. It was bizarre. I came to Congress as a conservative reformer, going after the supposed pillars of the establishment, like the private bank that let congressmen pass bad checks and the private restaurant that let them skip out on their tabs. I pushed for spending cuts and entitlement reforms when they were unpopular topics, when the get-along, go-along mentality prevailed. Now I was being denounced by the talk show circuit as if I were a hippie with flip-flops and beads plotting a socialist takeover of America. I didn't get it. I hadn't changed. I was the same guy, and I'm still the same guy today. But I didn't give a damn what anybody said about me, if at least we could get something done. But that wasn't happening either. The fight over immigration reform was a classic example from my time as Speaker. This was a major issue the parties have been arguing about for decades. And in 2013, a bipartisan group of senators, dubbed the Gang of Eight, came out with a major immigration bill that passed the Senate with bipartisan support, and they got dumped in our laps in the House. I knew that the Gang of Eight bill was dead on arrival at the House. And part of that had to do with certain House Republicans who had made a name for themselves as demagogues on the immigration issue. One of the worst was Steve King of Iowa, who famously said that young immigrants brought to the United States illegally as children had calves the size of cantaloupes because they were hauling 75 pounds of marijuana across the desert. It was an awful thing to say, and he got ripped for it, rightly. People would deliver actual cantaloupes to his office. I called him an asshole, and then sometime later he stopped me in a hallway and asked me very seriously, "Why did you call me an asshole?" "Because you are," I said, and kept walking. He was, and probably still is. His constituents saw fit to get rid of him in a primary in June of 2020. While the Senate Gang of Eight was getting all the press attention on immigration, there was a bipartisan group of House members who had been working quietly for years to come up with our own immigration deal. and they've been damn close. If they'd been literally standing on either side of a line, they would only have been about an inch apart. And I knew that if we wanted serious Democrat buy-in on the House plan, it didn't make sense to go talk to the Senate. I needed to go to the president. And I was convinced that two of the three areas of disagreement between Republicans and Democrats in the House immigration bill could be resolved in a one-hour meeting between President Obama and myself. I had wanted to make an immigration reform deal for a long time, and I'd made that clear to Obama. This was a festering issue that wasn't going to solve itself, and it was stirring up some pretty nasty rancor. But I knew that the way to get it done wasn't one giant bill, but with five or six smaller ones. This is how we were going to get it through the House. It would be a nightmare trying to get enough House members to agree to everything all at once, with so many facets. But if you broke the measures up, I thought, there would be a solid coalition of 300 or so members, Republicans and Democrats, who would vote for each one. Maybe they all wouldn't vote for the same ones, but the votes would be there for each. You could still end up with a comprehensive immigration reform, just in more digestible pieces. I ended up getting stymied from both sides. I would say to Obama, "Mr. President, if you're serious about this, here are the things I would do, and here are the things I would not do." And I'll be damned if he didn't always do the exact opposite of what I suggested. This was a different kind of interaction than when we would discuss economic issues. President Obama was a serious negotiator when it came to fiscal matters. But with immigration reform, I don't believe he was really interested in a solution. He just kept poisoning the well with things that he knew we would never agree to. He would politicize everything to no end. I'm not sure how to account for the difference in President Obama, who worked on serious fiscal deals with me, and the President Obama, who seemed to phone in on immigration reform. Maybe he thought it was more politically advantageous to leave immigration unsolved so that Democrats could continue to campaign on it as a wedge issue. That might have been bad policy, but it could still be good politics. God knows there were plenty of Republicans who felt that way. I had to deal with them too. The chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, which had jurisdiction over immigration, was Representative Bob Gutlatt of Virginia, a friend of mine going back to the days when we served together on the Agriculture Committee. Bob was very much a hardliner on immigration, and he refused to budge from his hard right position. Nothing would get him to move an inch toward compromise. I don't know whether it was his committee, his staff, his district, or just him, but he never moved, and I couldn't track him with one hand and President Obama with the other. The failure of our grand bargain on spending and entitlement reform is my biggest regret from my time in Congress. In that case, though, everyone seemed to make their best honest effort, at least until things fell apart at the very end, when, I maintain, they really didn't have to. But my second biggest disappointment was seeing the unwillingness in both parties to seriously fix our immigration laws so that they actually worked for real people. That was just stubbornness, plain and simple. Early on in this book, I talked about power. I thought it was important for any book that deals with Washington Annex to make clear that power, especially in that city, doesn't stick around. As I said, a dog that shits quick doesn't shit long. Nobody can hang on to power forever. And even if you look like you're in charge, new centers of power can pop up and destabilize everything. For instance, when I became Speaker of the House, I got a fancy new office where I could make any rule I wanted. Finally, I could smoke in my office, and nobody could say shit. That was nice. I held an important constitutional position and was second in line to the presidency. Big deal. Under the new rules of Crazy Town, I may have been Speaker, but I didn't hold all the power. By 2013, the Chaos Caucus in the House had built up their own power base thanks to fawning right-wing media and outrage-driven fundraising. And now, they had a new lunatic leading the way who wasn't even a House member. There is nothing more dangerous than a reckless asshole who thinks he's smarter than everyone else. Ladies and gentlemen, meet Ted Cruz. Ted was one of those guys you meet who has all the answers. You know the kind of person I'm talking about. We've all met them at work, in the neighborhood, on your rec league softball team. They've always got a solution for everything. They're very sure of themselves, and they're very calculating when it comes to making sure their pronouncements are followed. I don't trust people like that, but they're out in force in Washington, D.C. Time and again, I've seen people get elected to office, and after 15 minutes, they decide they know how to run the place better than those of us who scraped and scrapped our way to the top over decades by putting in the work. The capacity for politicians to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory and do it happily will never cease to amaze me. And it's hard to think of a better example of that than the 2013 government shutdown. Since Obamacare had become law a few years earlier, Republicans have been working on a strategy to repeal and replace it. I had to work damn hard to keep the bill from passing, reminding my Democrat colleagues with strong language that there was no way they could claim their bill was written with the openness and transparency necessary for good government. "Hell no, you can't," was how I believe I put it at the time. Once the bill passed and was signed into law, I campaigned damn hard to help elect more Republicans, take back the House, and work to get rid of it. And while we took back the majority in 2010, I promised to work damn hard to make good on that pledge and repeal it. Easier said than done, of course. By 2013, the law was still on the books, and a lot of people were understandably frustrated. Hell, imagine how frustrated I was. I wanted to rip up Obamacare more than anybody. But I also knew what our efforts were up against. Ted Cruz may have known what we were up against, too. But like his knucklehead pals on the House side, he had ginned up his voters with a black-and-white promise to get rid of it, come hell or high water. Well, that might sound good to people who are pissed off, and because they have real jobs and better things to do, they don't pay that much attention to how Washington really works. The dirty little secret of Obamacare was that parts of it were popular, especially protecting people with pre-existing conditions from getting bounced off their health care by some insurance company. The other little secret is that as hard as it is to pass a law like Obamacare in the first place, it can be just as hard or harder to repeal or unpass it. The way to do it is to dismantle key components of it bit by bit. And we were actually able to do that to Obamacare during our 2011 to 2019 majority. Not that Hannity and Levin and company gave us any credit. We got rid of provisions like the medical device tax to bring the burden on companies and individual Americans down to a more manageable level. And now, there really isn't much of Obamacare left. But Cruz and his buddies didn't understand any of that. They didn't care. Ted Cruz didn't come up to veteran legislators who shared his priorities and asked our advice on how to get something like this done. He wanted it done in one fell swoop, and it was his way or the highway. And the rest of us, who opposed Obamacare but didn't kill it immediately, we were just stupid, lazy, or worse, traitors. We weren't as noble as he was, not that anyone could be. And he convinced a lot of the crazies in my House Republican conference that this was true, so they followed him. That brings us to the fall of 2013, when the federal government had to vote on whether to raise our debt ceiling, the amount of money the United States is allowed to borrow to keep the government functioning. I hated this vote. Anyone who cared about fiscal responsibility hated it. Nobody was proud of the fact that we had to keep voting to raise the debt ceiling because we couldn't control government spending. But not voting to raise the debt ceiling meant that the government would stop running. The country wouldn't be able to pay its bills and would risk going into default on the money we owed. Over time, that meant parks would close, essential services, getting out the mail, processing tax returns, paying the members of the military, all would be imperiled. Government agencies would eventually run out of money. That didn't seem to bother the crazy caucus, not that they realized that it was their constituents, along with everyone else, who would feel the pinch of a non-functioning government. So Ted Cruz and a couple of other accomplices came up with the idea to put a price tag on Republican support for raising the debt limit, which the Obama administration needed because we were the majority in the House. The price tag was killing Obamacare. The strategy was to make the White House destroy their prized legacy legislative accomplishment in exchange for Republicans taking a routine vote to keep the government running. This was a dumbass idea. Not that many asked me. In the first place, it was bad messaging. The Obama administration was just starting to launch enrollment on the Obamacare healthcare exchanges, which was turning into a PR disaster. The website wasn't working right. It was confusing. The Obama team looked like amateurs. It was the best unforced error we Republicans could have hoped for. But that was all going to be overlooked if Republicans decided to launch a stunt like this. The press had actually been covering problems with the Obamacare rollout because they were real news. But I knew if given the choice between covering Democrat screw-ups and Republican screw-ups, the press would shine the bigger light on Republicans any day of the week. More practically, I also knew that there was no way in hell President Obama would ever give in on his signature achievement just to appease Ted Cruz and the radicals. Obama was open to making deals, yes, but this wasn't a real deal. This was insanity. He would blame us for putting the economy in peril by refusing to vote for the debt limit, and the media would only be too happy to push that narrative. We'd end up looking like a bunch of fools. It never made sense from the beginning, but Cruz, who was already stacking up Cruz for President yard signs in his garage, has started ginning up the Tea Party knuckleheads in July 2013. At least twice before everyone left town for the August recess, I talked to our members to try to convince them that this was a bad idea. But Cruz and company took advantage of the recess to convince Republicans around the country that this suicide mission was the only way to get rid of Obamacare. I tried to do the opposite. Like I did every August, I toured around the country in a bus raising money for Republican members and maybe playing a little golf here and there along the way. That month, I did two conference calls from the road with as many members as we could muster, trying to convince them that this just wasn't going to work. When the House came back into session after Labor Day, I kept at it. I tried to talk to members informally, which had worked in the past on all kinds of issues, laying out to them in plain, if salty English, that this would just end up playing right into the hands of Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid, not to mention the White House. They were all sitting on their sides of the Capitol and down Pennsylvania Avenue just waiting for us to step in a big pile of our own shit. At our conference meeting on September 9th in the basement of the Capitol, Cantor and I tried to put up a compromise plan. We would force votes in the House and in the Senate to strip Obamacare of its funding, but without hitching the votes to funding the government. Our House Republican majority would make its stand and force the Democrat-run Senate to make theirs, but without tying it to funding of the rest of the government. We couldn't be blamed if the government shut down or ran out of money, or at least it would be harder for Democrats and the media to blame us. Suffice it to say, the plan was not well received by the members. I seem to recall there was booing. It was then that I saw how far the chaos campaign had gone. When we got to the open mic portion of the meeting, member after member, including some of the practical, down-to-earth folks I'd known for years, were speaking in support of this fight. To have Tim Uhlenkamp from Kansas or Ted Yoho from Florida pushing for this was expected. But when guys like Chris Stewart from Utah joined in, as reasonable and level-headed as they came, I knew this had truly become the will of the conference. And as I've often said, a leader without followers is just a guy taking a walk. I knew the crazies of my conference. There was no talking to them. They were being urged on by the talk radio crowd and the cable news know-nothings. Many of them came from deep red states with no viable Democrat challengers, so there was no real pressure on them back home. Besides, their idols in the upper chamber, you know, like Ted Cruz and Mike Lee, were telling them this was a genius move. Some members have a bit of a complex when it comes to the Senate. Sometimes it can seem like senators are the seniors in high school and House members are just the juniors. When seniors give juniors the time of day, the juniors don't ask why. They just go along with it. Well, I never bought into this. I saw a fair amount of it. A member is more likely to fall for this if they don't take the time to get to know and respect their own institution, the House of Representatives, which most of the crazies, as staunch anti-institutionalists, do not. And thus the great prophet, Ted, spoke unto the people and told them President Obama would cave. He showed us all. At the very least, he and his acolytes promised this would force the president to the table to give Republicans something to cut a deal. Of course, none of them had met Barack Obama for any length of time or had ever tried to negotiate with him. As I said, He was open to making deals, but at the negotiating table, he was the coolest customer Gop ever put on Earth. But that didn't matter. Ted Cruz knew everything and could outmaneuver Obama. Just wait and see. Remember, Ted Cruz may have been the leader of this effort in Congress, but there were plenty of forces at work pushing him from the outside. These would be the so-called conservative outside groups. And that was where the big payday came in. There was Jim DeMint's Senate Conservative Fund. Another was FreedomWorks, which used to be headed by my old colleague Dick Armey, until he quit after they went totally nuts. One of the worst was Heritage Action for America, an arm of the once venerable Heritage Foundation. It was as if the respectable conservative scholars at Heritage had decided to set up a JV team of whiny campaign operatives and pay them to attack other conservatives. These groups knew how to do one thing well, raise money. And they loved to fundraise by attacking the establishment, whatever that was, and the House leadership, which was me. We did our best to push back. I remember Jeb Henschling, a conservative whose right-wing credentials were unquestionable, who had served in the leadership as conference chair and was then chairing the Financial Services Committee, stood up dramatically in one of our member meetings and reminded everyone that nobody, not Heritage Action or anybody else, could tell them how to vote. Henschling combined brains with Texas toughness, but even he couldn't sway the crazies. So I was finally the one who caved. Sometimes you have to let people blow themselves up to make a point. Besides, I didn't really have much of a choice. I either had to strap the dynamite to them or to myself. Okay, I said, I'll go along. At least they wouldn't be able to call me an establishment asshole anymore. And sure enough, when I did come on board, I was treated like a hero. I was finally a true conservative, whatever that meant to them. Never mind that I'd been fighting for real conservative values in Congress while most of these clowns were still in law school. What kamikaze stunts like this had to do with conservatism, I never quite figured out. And I don't think they did either. I knew how this was going to end. We were on the Titanic playing chicken with an iceberg, and a loudmouth jerk from Texas was at the helm, grinning like a damn fool as the water started to fill up the boat. By September 18th, I was committed to going along with this. And once I was committed, I made the case as forcefully as I could. To most outside observers, I looked like I was totally on board. I went on the talk shows. I held press conferences. No one could say, and to their credit, no one did say, I wasn't in this fight. The conservatives were beside themselves. The House Republicans were finally united. United in insanity. But sure, whatever. As dumb as I thought it was, I was the leader, and this was my job, and I went into the trenches every single day. That meant going out in front of the TV cameras pushing our case. It meant coming up with proposals to try to get the Senate to negotiate. I was constantly in touch with President Obama and Harry Reid, trying to find some common ground, some fig leaf to get us out of this mess. And over the last 2 weeks of September, we tried to make the deal more palatable to the Democrats. We walked back our demand to kill Obamacare entirely and instead tried to get them to delay its full rollout for a year, a request that wasn't all that ridiculous considering the problems they'd already had with the exchange websites, plus get rid of the tax on medical devices, which was still on the books. No dice. I still hope we could somehow avoid a shutdown. At the last minute, we offered to let the Democrats keep the medical device tax if they would hold off putting Obamacare in place for a year. I just needed some bone to throw to my members, some tiny scrap from the Democrats that we could spin as a win. But the Dems turned down every offer. Forget the fig leaves. Obama and Reid never gave me a twig. Nothing. Zero. Nada. They knew they didn't have to. They knew we were the ones who would get blamed. Whatever happened. And of course they were right. Bastards. And by the way, what was Senator Cruz of Texas doing while I was scrambling around trying to keep the government running as September ran to a close? He was listening to himself hold forth during a 21-hour speech, which for some technical Senate reasons couldn't be called a filibuster. It was yet another stunt, during which he read Dr. Seuss's classic, Green Eggs and Ham on the Senate Floor. But you can't govern by stunt, and eventually we couldn't govern at all. The government shut down on October 1st. The meetings went on, as did our attempts to make our case in front of the TV cameras. Our serious members and those dedicated staff who had been declared essential, other federal workers had been furloughed, still came to work diligently trying to negotiate a way out of this. The crazies were desperate to get something, anything out of the standoff so they could go back home and claim some sort of victory. That made sense, I suppose, except for one thing. Obama knew that too, and he still had us by the balls. In case anyone was keeping track, the idea that a Democrat president was going to stand by and give Republicans the power to screw with his legacy of enacting a longtime liberal priority was, yep, still insane. But we were in it now. I gave it my very best with Schumer and Reid and Pelosi and Obama. They all looked at me like I was crazy. I'm sure Mitch McConnell felt the same way, but at least he was a little more polite about it. The first week of October came and went, and suddenly we were looking down the barrel at October 17th, the day the Treasury Department had declared that the government would run out of money unless we raised the debt ceiling. Obama showed zero signs of caving. He blamed Republicans for trying to hold America hostage to score political points. Most people in the media agreed. This was the narrative that dominated the opinion columns and newscast. Another blow came on October 15th when Fitch, the credit ratings agency, publicly threatened to downgrade the nation's excellent AAA bond rating, which would have been another nasty gut punch to the economy. As the Treasury deadline got closer, our house crazies went even further out to lunch. I didn't think it was possible, but they found a way to lose even more touch with reality. They started to claim that the October 17th deadline didn't mean anything, that somehow the Treasury could just wave a magic wand and prevent a default. Maybe this was the denial stage of grief, I'm not sure. But one of the loudest voices pushing this was Mick Mulvaney, who later, as head of Trump's Office of Management and Budget, presided over dramatic growth of the national debt and the budget deficit. By this time, I had started to hear from some of the other folks in my conference, the non-crazy ones. They were, to put it politely, freaking out. These were the people from tougher districts who actually had to worry about fighting for re-election. Not everyone had Cruz's luxury of throwing bombs from the comfort of then ruby red Texas. We had plenty of members from lighter red or purple districts, and they were starting to get shit from back home. They quickly started to loathe Cruz and company for getting us into this mess in the first place. It wasn't just my House colleagues who felt this way. In fact, the reaction from some of Cruz's Senate colleagues was even more, shall we say, pointed. Unlike House members who generally, with some exceptions like Delaware and the Dakotas, represent a particular area within a state, senators represent the whole state. They have to respond to a more diverse population, and because of that, they tend to be more moderate, on average. Senate races are often more competitive, so the Senate is not a natural home for bomb throwers. Most Republican senators didn't like Ted Cruz from the beginning. Mitch McConnell hated him with a passion. I didn't know Mitch had it in him. And they all gave his crazy plan about 10 minutes to fail, knowing and hoping that it would do so in a spectacular fashion. So naturally, these folks became Cruz's targets, too. He railed against anyone in his own party that wasn't as pure as he was. They were the creatures of the swamp, or some such nonsense. At the time, I remember thinking it seemed a little strange that Cruz was concentrating so much fire on his Republican colleagues, since it was also obvious that his turbocharged ambition would lead him to run for president at the first opportunity. Anyone in Washington who had two peas between his ears knew that those colleagues he savaged regularly in the press would be delighted to return the favor just when it hurt him the most. That turned out to be exactly what happened. When Cruz ran for president in 2016, my buddy Lindsey Graham declared, "If you killed Cruz on the floor of the Senate and the trial was in the Senate, nobody would convict you." Around the same time, I called him a miserable son of a bitch and Lucifer in the flesh in front of an audience at Stanford University. I figured in an academic setting, it was better to be polite. After a little more than 2 weeks of shutdown, the act started to wear thin. The momentum had shifted to the Mod Squad, the more moderate Republican members who were leading the calls within our conference to end the shutdown. So I walked into another emergency all-conference meeting in the Capitol basement and announced, "This fight is over. Today." I could never have guessed what would happen next. The place erupted into cheers. I got a standing ovation from every member in the room, including the knuckleheads. They all, God only knows why, were happy we'd fought the fight, no matter how much credibility with the public and leverage with the Democrats it cost us. The media scolded us, of course. But then on November 1st, the Obamacare exchanges opened for business with a disastrous, glitch-filled online rollout. It was a mess. And so we moved on to the next crisis. The D.C. press had another story to cover, and we had something to hit the Dems back with. If listening to this story now doesn't make sense to you, congratulations. I didn't understand it either. I still don't. That's got to be one of the most bizarre events I've seen in politics, and given what I've seen in my career, that's saying something. But maybe that's the most consistent lesson I've learned from the political game. Weird shit is just going to keep happening, so you might as well give up being surprised. Even though we didn't win on the debt limit, did I think it was a noble fight on principle? Did I think it made an important point to the nation? Nope. It made Republicans look weak, ineffective, and more interested in stunts than getting stuff done for our voters. Well, was it worth it? Not at all. But at least I could console myself with the fact that, for a moment, we were all on one team. For a moment, my party was sane again. For a moment. I suppose I should have seen it coming. The year that ended with a crisis had begun with one, too. And that time, too, I had ended up leading a fight I knew we couldn't win. Barack Obama was reelected to the presidency in November of 2012, defeating our nominee, Mitt Romney. Romney was a straight shooter who ran a good, honest campaign, and I was especially proud that he chose my House colleague and former campaign volunteer, Paul Ryan, to be his running mate. Romney got in trouble for pointing out, pretty much correctly, in a private setting that Obama had 47% of the voters locked up because they pay no income tax and are dependent upon the government. Never mind that according to the Tax Policy Center, 46.4% of households did not, in fact, pay any federal income tax in 2011. The media saw a chance to jump down a Republican's throat for being insensitive, and they did it with relish. If only they could have imagined the kind of stuff Donald Trump would say on the campaign trail in 2016, Romney would have sounded like a choir boy. Obama still faced headwinds going into the election. The economy was barely limping along. The disastrous attack on our consulate in Benghazi, Libya, that left four Americans dead hadn't done any favors for his image as commander-in-chief or the credibility of his Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton. My House Republican colleagues and I campaigned hard for Romney and our buddy Paul, but Obama won fair and square. Oh well, we still held the House majority, but we were still the opposition in Washington, just as things had been in Obama's first term. At least things hadn't gotten any worse, right? No such luck. Obama had made the bold promise during his reelection campaign to raise taxes on anybody who made over $200,000 a year. But that wasn't the only tax threat that Americans were about to face. December 31st, 2012 was the point when a whole lot of tax cuts, from those enacted during George W. Bush's administration to temporary measures we negotiated with Obama in 2010, were expected to expire. They called that the fiscal cliff, and we were barreling toward it. Going over the cliff would mean that significant cuts in government spending would go into effect, which was a good thing. But Obama cleverly was counting on the fact that the expired tax cuts, something individual Americans could see and feel and understand, would make a bigger political splash. Between Obama's drive to raise taxes and other tax cuts set to expire, lots and lots of Americans were about to take a hit in their paychecks. We knew this could kill the small businesses, too. Republicans weren't about to just let that happen. So as 2012 came to an end, we spun the negotiating wheels into gear. And Obama, to his credit, offered to raise his limit on the tax increase to people making over $400,000 a year. That wasn't great, but it was better than 200. And the president had a lot of leverage. The mandate of a recent election, not to mention the media in his corner. But I thought we could do better. I thought we could protect more Americans from more hurt on their tax receipts. So I came back to the White House with $1 million. I was tired of Republicans, and especially poor Mitt Romney, who had done well for himself, being blasted by the left and by the press for only caring about millionaires and billionaires. Well, here we were offering a different tax hike on millionaires and sparing a huge chunk of the American middle class. I hoped Obama would take that as a show of good faith, a sign that we were serious. And who showed up to torpedo everything? The so-called conservatives in the House Republican Conference, of course. They wouldn't budge on any tax increase under any circumstances. Most Republicans, when they came to Congress, signed a pledge put out by Grover Norquist, Americans for Tax Reform Group, never to raise taxes in office. And even Grover, to his credit, announced that this deal wouldn't count as violating the pledge. But I guess even he now was too establishment for these kooks. They didn't listen. They refused to back the plan to raise the limit to $1 million. What was so conservative about their argument, I still don't understand. Why would any self-proclaimed anti-tax warrior choose to put the hurt on more Americans when they had the option to put the hurt on fewer, who would be better able to absorb it? There were masses of American taxpayers making between $400,000 and $1 million, including many small business owners, who all could have gotten a break. Yes, we still would have had to get Obama and the Dems to agree to it, but at least the House, showing unity behind the $1 million plan, would have given us a better hand. But no, that was too much to hope for. As it happens, we just played right into the left's argument. Now it looked like Republicans cared so much about millionaires, they were willing to screw over all Americans making between $400,000 and $999,999 just to protect their super-rich friends. That was just great. This was pure, blind, knee-jerk ideology, and it reflected the mood on the right at the time. So many of the members who were elected to the House in 2010 had gotten there by challenging more sane politicians from the right in primaries, and they were terrified someone was waiting in the wings to do the same to them. Live by the sword, die by the sword. Primary was now widely used as a verb, as in, if I don't vote with the crazies, I'm going to get primaried. And even if Grover Norquist had stood this one down, there were plenty of other old pals in the outside conservative groups ready to eat their own, running ads and funding challengers attacking normal Republicans for, quote, raising taxes. We were trying to prevent an even bigger tax hike at the bottom of the fiscal cliff, but of course, that didn't matter. Once again, I was at the negotiating table basically naked. My own party had taken away my boxer shorts. With about 2 weeks left in 2012 and the cliff approaching, I had no more leverage with Obama and Harry Reid. We just had to accept whatever they offered now. I remembered I recited the Serenity Prayer live on TV. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things that I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. It seemed like the right thing to say. I admit this fight took a lot out of me. Anybody who knows me knows I don't do angry, especially not at work. You hear stories about some representatives or senators throwing staplers or shoving all the papers off their desk in a rage. I knew plenty of angry people, but that wasn't me. I never got mad at my staff, ever. Colleagues were a different story. I get mad at them very rarely. But at one of these meetings at the White House toward the end of the fiscal cliff negotiation, I lost it on Harry Reid. He'd been talking all kinds of shit on the Senate floor, calling the House a dictatorship of the Speaker. I'm sorry, but fuck that. I never ran the House like a dictatorship. If I were a dictator, do you think I'd let all these members get away with screwing me over all the time? Hell no. And Reid, who was a ruthless bastard, knew exactly what he was doing. That speech was aimed right at the House crazies. He was trying to gin them up even more and make my position even worse. So when I saw him at the White House the next day, talking quietly with McConnell before the meeting, I went over and got in Reid's face and said, Do you ever listen to all that shit that comes out of your mouth? You can go fuck yourself. I guess he wasn't used to people getting in his face like that. He couldn't think of anything to say back to me. I guess he was taken aback that someone had called him out on his bullshit. Weirdly enough, our relationship got a lot better after that. Poor McConnell, though. Mr. Decorum was a stunned and horrified witness to this angry encounter. I thought he was going to keel over from cardiac arrest right then and there. There was another outburst a few days later when the House voted on the Senate's bill to solve the crisis on New Year's Day 2013. The final version kept the tax increase on everyone making over $400,000, but everyone below that level got a break with the extension of the Bush tax cuts. The bill passed in the House with a majority Democrat support, but a little more than a third of the Republicans joined in. All that was left of the Sanity Caucus. A couple of high-profile defections really pissed me off. Eric Cantor was one, and the majority whip Kevin McCarthy was the other. These were the guys who were supposed to have helped me build support for the $1 billion plan, and to see them lose their faith at the end was something I couldn't stand. When I learned about it, I said something like, "Are you shitting me?" Which I really shouldn't have done on the House floor. I went to talk to the boys to try to figure out what they were up to, and maybe to knock their heads together, but they both scurried out of the chamber before I could catch them. But you know who did decide to cast a grown-up vote in favor of the deal? Paul Ryan. That was a moment where he showed he was ready to lead and make the tough calls, often required of a good leader. I had that in mind when I worked a couple of years later to convince him to take over the speakership, even though he really didn't want the job. Anyway, it wasn't a great way to start a new year, and it was a preview of the shutdown nonsense to come in a couple of months. But here's the real point of these stories. Most of these guys who poke up their heads in these crises and vote no on every compromise and claim they're doing it all for conservative principles don't actually give a shit about fiscal responsibility. If they did, you'd think they'd be slap-happy excited when a Republican president came to Washington who, with a House and Senate majority, could make serious progress in getting our national debt and entitlement spending under control. Guess what? None of these guys said anything when the Trump administration added $1 trillion to the federal budget deficit by the end of 2019, before a single dime was spent on COVID-19 relief. There were rubber stamps for it in Congress. Many of them who had raised huge stinks about TARP were only too happy to let Trump bail out farmers hurt by his trade war with China. These are the same people who are willing to destroy our economy to make their point, but went on to suddenly abandon this core principle. And why? Because it's not really about the money. It's not about principle. It's about chaos. If it were about principle, they'd have stuck to their principles no matter who was in power. The numbers don't lie. In its first 3 years in power, before the pandemic, the Trump administration grew our national debt by $3 trillion. COVID-19 relief spending brought the growth total up to $5.2 trillion by May of 2020. As I said, that's not all Donald Trump's fault. The coronavirus pandemic was an unprecedented situation, and Congress and the administration did the right thing, spending money to address it. Still, the U.S. Congress, which allocates government funding, was controlled by Republicans up until the start of 2019, before the pandemic became a spending priority. You would think that folks like Mulvaney and Cruz and all those who are willing to destroy our entire economy to hold the line on spending would have kept up their hardline views, fighting spending programs every step of the way. Nope, not a peep from any of them. Mulvaney, as I've mentioned, even went on to work as the head of Trump's Office of Management and Budget, which oversees federal spending. He didn't say a word, even as his administration way outspent Barack Obama, even when he became Trump's acting chief of staff. Guess who succeeded him as chief, by the way? Mark Meadows, who tried to kick me out of the speaker's chair for not being fiscally conservative enough. I guess these trillions in Trump debt didn't bother him a bit. No, most of these guys weren't about principles. They were about chaos and power. Don't get me wrong. The Democrats are far from guilt-free in all this. They never seemed to care much about controlling federal spending when I was in Congress. Now the far-left lunatics have become the center of gravity in their party. What Nancy Pelosi and other sane Democrats, the ones who've been around long enough to know how things work, are dealing with from AOC and her squad reminds me a lot of what I had to deal with during my days as Speaker from the far-right gooks of the Tea Party or the Freedom Caucus, or whatever they're calling themselves. The difference is that the Freedom Caucus usually shared the same policies as the rest of the GOP conference. The disagreements were mostly over tactics. They always wanted to get into a fight with somebody, which is pretty screwed up if you think about it. The squad on the left, meanwhile, has a policy agenda, a radical one that smart Democrats know is A, unrealistic, B, unworkable, and C, alienating to the rest of the country. Democratic socialism just isn't going to play. But these people command a large social media and press following. So Pelosi has to argue with them about tactics and policy, which is a hell of a spot for her to be in. By the way, I can tell you with absolute certainty that she knows they're a bunch of kooks. Unlike them, Nancy lives in the real world. I will say I don't know anyone else on the Democrat side who can keep them in line as well as she can, or keep them from destroying themselves with some bullshit scheme. They are all screwed when she is off the scene. She handled the failed effort to impeach Donald Trump about as well as she could. I guess she did get the impeachment, but there was no way the Senate was going to convict him. And Pelosi knew that, no question about it. It was painful having to watch her give in to the far left. When Obama was president, as hated as he was by the GOP base, impeaching him might have been broached once or twice by one of the nuts in our conference, but never by anyone with half a brain. I'm pretty sure Nancy knew that a partisan impeachment of Trump was a political loser. As several polls reflected, it drew people who don't like Trump into his camp and lurched the Democrats further to the left. But she eventually had to give in, because she knows a leader without followers is just a person taking a walk. I'd have pointed the same thing out to Trump himself if he'd asked me. He would call me fairly often when he first took office for advice or conversation. I was never afraid to tell him when I thought he got it wrong, and give him some encouragement when he got it right. But the calls came less and less as his tenure went on. That's probably because he got more comfortable in the job, but I also suspect he got tired of me advising him to shut up.